Hey guys, it's the last episode of the season, and boy, are you in for a treat.
Today we sit down with the one and only Dean of the College, Jill Dolan.
We talk succession, COVID, blogs, and what it means to be a dean. Happy holidays, this is the Bechdel Test.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Bechdel Test. It's your favorite podcast.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Simon, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well
today. Good.
Yes.
Good. And Emily?
I'm just splendid.
You had really a big night last night.
Yeah, well, I'm splendid because I did have the best night of my life last night. And what was the thing called that we were at?
The Student Arts
Museum Gala.
The Museum Gala put on, it was like the Art Museum, the Student Advisory Board for the Art Museum put on a gala last night,
and Simon performed importantly. Yes. And he was wonderful.
He did great. And me and Sophia, we came
to dance
and to support him.
But that's not why you had the best night of your life.
It's not. So we're sitting there, and one of my friends, Kate, shout out Kate, comes up to me.
Shout out Kate.
And she says, here are some raffle tickets and you could possibly win one of the paintings. And I said, okay, let's do it. And I really wanted, all of the paintings were about, like, how big would you say they were?
Very, quite small.
An 8x11 inch,
right,
type, yeah, of thing.
Right.
But then there was one painting that was huge.
Massive.
It was probably like 3 feet by some other dimension.
3 feet by like one foot. But
this two is, by three. Yeah. It's a two
really
by three.
Important.
It's a
really
two by three.
You just need to know how big it is.
Our audience to be able to visualize
and
it.
And it was a man eating pasta. And I really, really
from
wanted it.
From the 17th century.
From the 17th century.
Like viciously eating pasta.
Viciously eating pasta. And I said, this is really valuable and I want it.
It was amazing. Like it's just a beautiful portrait that looks like, it looks like anachronistic in a way. It looks like it was like someone was trying to do a painting from the 17th century today and like did it some sort of comedic interpretation. But it was actually from the 17th century.
I didn't think it was funny at all. I thought it was...
Okay,
well, I took it very seriously.
I'm very sorry for trivializing your painting.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, all of my friends helped me out and they gave me all of their raffle tickets. So I had about 20 raffle tickets with my name on it going into this jar. I'd say I was about 60% of the raffle tickets in the jar. But
they might confiscate your painting after.
Really?
They might.
They listen to this.
I cheated. I did cheat. Needless to say, I won the painting.
Yes.
She won the painting,
everyone. I won the painting.
Woo! Yeah.
And now it's sitting in my room.
And here's the thing. It's a print. It's not the actual
painting. Yeah, it's also not the painting. Yeah.
So we were very confused.
It's a high-definition print of the painting.
But it's like cardboard. It's not. We're not talking about paper here.
It's
cardboard. It's
still a big deal.
Yeah.
Right. And you know how expensive cardboard is these days.
These days.
You can
tell me about it.
It's the scarcest material. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we just want to congratulate Emily on her big win.
Thank you. This just doesn't
happen every day.
No.
And so
I'm just beaming. You guys can't see it, you listeners, but I'm just beaming.
We'll post a picture of Emily and her painting on our Instagram.
And we might actually hold a raffle too.
Of the picture of Emily holding
and
that
a night,
picture.
And a dinner with Emily.
Yeah. Put your bets in. Bids.
Put your bets in.
Bet
on Emily.
Bet on me. Anybody. Anyway.
Anyway, let's introduce our incredible guest today.
Let's do it.
Today on the podcast, we have the final guest of this season. She's Princeton's Dean of the College, a position she's occupied since 2015, in which she oversees all undergraduate affairs. In other words, she's a huge deal. She has an award-winning blog, The Feminist Spectator. She's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and she's an author of many publications. After 9 great years as dean, she plans to step down next June. Yeah, you guessed it. It's Dean Jill Dolan. Woo!
Thank you. Glad to be here.
How are you
so
doing?
Especially after Emily's auspicious evening.
Yes.
What a great time to be here.
Seriously.
You didn't know you were sitting next to a celebrity right now.
I didn't know who has a pasta-eating cardboard.
Yes, it's a big deal.
It's a really big deal.
It's a big deal. Well, how are you doing, Dean?
I'm doing well, thank you. Glad,
good.
Really glad to be here.
We're so happy to have you.
Thank you.
Yes. So jumping into our first question here, since July 2015, you have served as Princeton's Dean of the College, in which you oversee all undergraduate affairs, including the curriculum, residential college system, admission, and financial aid. So how was the transition into this role in 2015?
Wow, that's a great question. It's also 9 years ago, but I remember it very well, partly because I'm not sure many people know what the Dean of the College does at Princeton.
Yeah.
And when I transitioned to the role, it turned out that I was one of those people. I mean, I knew a little bit about it, but it turns out it's kind of a big job. So I oversee the residential colleges, the McGraw Center, the international programs. There's 14 different units. So it took me probably the first year to get my arms around the scope of what the job is. Mm-hmm. There's no orientation. When President Eisgruber said, "I would like you to be the next dean of the college," I said, "Great, when's the orientation?" And he said, "There is none.
There is none.
Wow. Here's the keys. Have a really good time." I met the staff for the first time when I walked into the office with the keys. So I had a lot to learn, mm-hmm. I will say that. What I knew was that I was really excited about this role and what I might contribute to it, but I learned a lot about it as I went along. There's about 175 staff.
Wow.
In the office of the dean of the college, all of whom I'm very fond of 9 years later, but I didn't know the scope of the job when I agreed to do it.
Mm-hmm. What was the day-to-day like at the beginning, and then how has it evolved?
The day-to-day at the beginning, you know, when you come into these jobs, you kind of inherit someone else's plan. It's like a chef being told, here's the menu of your restaurant, and then gradually you have to tweak it and decide what you want to do with it. So I went to a lot of meetings that I wasn't quite sure what the intent was. Mm-hmm. I met a lot of people and had to figure out what those relationships were. And I kind of had to gradually put my own imprint on it.
Right.
I'm kind of fond of saying a lot of my job is sitting at tables with people, talking about what they do, what they'd like to do, and what we should do for students at Princeton. It's a lot of meetings, but I'm kind of amazed at how interesting meetings have become to me.
Mm.
I do a lot of sitting. That was something to acclimate to at first. But the conversations are really where the work is.
Right.
I don't usually wear headphones or talk into a microphone, but it's not unlike tables this, where depending on who's there, the ideas that get generated and the possibilities for what the work might be really do happen at the table, and then we figure out how to carry them forward after that. I think that meetings should always be interesting and never boring.
You're
That's
right.
something I learned as dean. They should be as short as possible.
Yes.
And as efficient as possible. So I've learned a lot in the role, but the day-to-day is very much about either committee meetings or one-on-one meetings or standing meetings, that sort of thing.
How do you try to make those meetings efficient and interesting at the same time?
Also a good question. We always have an agenda to start with, but if there isn't much of an agenda, I cancel. I want to make sure that there's really something that's
structure.
Going to happen.
Right.
Yeah. And I tend to be the kind of administrator who is more interested in the sticky philosophical ideas than just the pedestrian sort of day-to-day things, although those are really important too.
Yeah.
Right.
But as we're going through an agenda, for me, the interesting part is, what is this going to mean for, say, Princeton in the future? Or why can't we unknot this really complicated problem?
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, what can we do incrementally to get where we think we want to be? I try to keep an eye on the big issues, and that keeps it interesting.
Yeah.
And, like, what's been the most important issue to you during your, like, administration as dean of the college?
If I had to call out one thing, it would be the change in the demographics of the undergraduate population.
Okay.
Now, we're enormously lucky that at this point, 25% of our students come from lower income backgrounds. I think that's changed Princeton a whole lot in terms of who it is, in terms of the contrast between a very old history of elitism and fairly significant privilege to a place where it's much more accessible and there are more opportunities for more kinds of students. But it's also meant that our standard way of delivering the curriculum has had to change over time. It's partly because of the demographic changes, and it's partly, as you all know, because of the pandemic and what happened then and learning losses. It's because of the mental health challenge. I think we're at a moment where there's different students here than were here before, and all the students here are experiencing their college education in really different ways. And at the same time, we have a kind of old-fashioned curriculum in which Chem 101 is offered in the fall and not the spring.
Mm-hmm.
in which the assumption is everybody does 4 years in lockstep and never takes a leave and happily graduates on time. And it, for lots of reasons, it just doesn't happen that way anymore.
No. Yeah.
So the process of trying to accommodate a really different set of student needs across the population with a curriculum that anticipates really a student from the 1950s or 60s.
Right.
That's been a really interesting challenge.
Wow. So you mentioned COVID, which was obviously an unprecedented event for
goodness.
For the entire university community, for the world. And so how was it serving like the undergraduate, you know, class during this event? Like how was the transition into COVID? How was the transition out of COVID?
Oh my goodness.
How was the period during COVID?
I'll try not to get PTSD as I talk about this. It was such a wild thing because no one could anticipate that it was going to happen. There was just no way to prepare. I'll never forget the day we decided to send the students home.
Mm-hmm.
It was 2 days before spring break was supposed to start, and it was starting to become clear that maybe it wasn't a good idea to continue our residential education. But as you can imagine, it was a huge challenge to say, okay, we're going to send students home for this break and invite them to stay home instead of coming back. I mean, that pivot was just remarkable. We had been thinking about it. I had been talking to my staff about it, and I went to a meeting with the president and the provost and the executive vice president, sort of all the decision makers, and they were all sitting around a table in Nassau Hall, spread out.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of looked at them and said, why are you all sitting there? And they said, well, we're social distancing.
A new term.
I wasn't sure what that meant and why having one seat in between them would make it safer somehow. But we sat down and I said, I think we have to send the student. I think we have to do it now.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody said, I think we have to do it now. And we did it. It was just cataclysmic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then making the announcement and seeing the student reactions and everybody on Prospect Street crying and hugging each other and spreading COVID. You know, it was a really exciting moment. But then even how were we supposed to deliver a Princeton education? Because it wasn't like we were closing. We were just sending everyone home.
Right.
So the McGraw Center really had to shift into gear to figure out what Zoom was. No one knew what Zoom was.
Right.
No one knew what remote teaching was. And what's incredible to me in retrospect is that we kind of did it. Everybody learned how to do it. We got hardware and software to people who didn't have access to what they needed in order to be able to learn remotely. And people finished the semester and then the whole next year, too. But mostly, we were all so unprepared and had to make it up as we went along. It was like being in an improv comedy troupe.
Yeah.
You know, oh, look at this situation someone has given us. How are we going to get ourselves out of this one? But we did, and that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's incredible.
I hope it never happens again.
Yeah,
no.
Me neither.
Although if it did, we're a little more prepared.
Indeed.
But
just
that sense of an impending crisis that no one has done a drill for and just having to figure it out on the fly.
Yeah. And people are still recovering from that.
Right.
Still recovering
from
it.
Like on a professional level, on just a personal level too.
Absolutely.
Do you feel like you are still like recovering?
I think I am. In fact, you know, I say I've done 9 years as dean. I might have done a few more, but those 3 years of COVID make me feel like I've been dean for 19 years.
Exactly.
Right.
they were just everything intensified. And even though I was working from home and didn't see my colleagues for 2.5 years, it was a really intense, exhausting time. Mm-hmm. So yes, I feel like I'm still recovering. And I think the campuses too.
Yeah.
You know, there were a lot of people who just weren't accustomed to being with one another face-to-face for a long time. When students first came back, a lot of faculty were saying, people are really having trouble making eye contact around my seminar table, just how we get reacclimated to being in the same space together and trusting that we weren't going to get one another sick, too, I think is
absolutely
a lasting effect.
Right. No, I remember going from, because I was on Zoom for an entire year of high school. Even after like the initial like spring break to the end of the year, I was on Zoom for the whole year, and then like going back to high school for my senior year, and like being around so many people, so many more people than I'd ever been around for like over a year and a half was insane.
Yeah.
And then when you were first wearing masks, and so then like you know you could make. indecent facial expressions when anyone did anything you might disagree with. Yeah. And then the transition away from mask, you had to stop doing that. Right. Yeah. So it's just relearning social skills.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Or even how to make social expressions.
Right.
I know.
Yeah. I think it'll be the most interesting, too, to see the people that were a couple years younger than us that were in middle school, mm-hmm. like very formative years.
Yeah.
For social competence, I guess, right. where yeah. like they were home for like a whole year.
They're going to be some weird adults in like 10 years.
It should be interesting.
It should be interesting to see.
It has a very long tail, this pandemic.
Yeah, well, indeed. My developmental psych professor, I think he might be studying it now, like the impact of COVID, or at least he's just interested in it. But he did a class where he talked about it, and his theory is just this, I mean, it's pretty intuitive, but the fact that like the kids that are in this developmental like transition period, so like academically, if you're going into middle school, like right when you're going into high school or going into college, like when COVID hit, like those are, you're impacted the most.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you can see like, I think there have already been tons of studies in psychology about this, but yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see,
yeah,
see the impact of it.
So Dean Dolan, as you mentioned, so you serve as a point of contact for undergraduates for many of the university's most consequential and emotional announcements, whether it's COVID or like announcing the deaths of multiple students. Mm. So did it often feel like you had to process such news for the campus community before you could really process it personally?
That's such a good question, too. You know, anytime there's a tragedy or a crisis, what I try to do as a way of processing it, knowing that I'll have to say something about it, because, mm-hmm. as you said, typically with my colleagues, the vice president for campus life, Rochelle Calhoun, sometimes with the dean of the faculty, depending on who's being addressed, we compose these emails together. But the way I think about it is always, how are we as a campus going to assimilate this news? I try to put myself in other people's shoes and think on the basis of real empathy and compassion for what we're all going through. So I do have to process things myself, but I think because of my position, I'm always thinking about what can we say to other people that will give them the most comfort and express the most compassion. You know, this question about the we of a campus community, mm-hmm. I always kind of wonder who that is, because there's so many of us that comprise this notion of Princeton and their community. Mm-hmm. But at moments like that, I think you do all draw together somehow in a sense of loss when a student dies, in a sense of fear when there's some sort of crisis. So I try to assume that sense of who can the we be in that moment, who I can speak to in a way that offers the most empathy or solace. It's very pastoral, mm-hmm. those yeah. moments. And that helps me take care of myself, too.
Yeah.
And so I guess another thing that's really interesting to me is, so you went from being a professor, and like, yes, you were the director of Princeton's program in gender and sexuality from 2009 to 2015, but then you're like dropped into this very outward facing role. Mm. And so how was that? Because suddenly you're like prone to like media criticism, criticism from the student body, other groups. And so like, how was that?
Yes, that's a very good question. I became dean in 2015 in July. In mm-hmm. November 2015, I'm sure you've all read about the Black Justice League sit-in in Nassau Hall. So I'd been dean for maybe 3 months, and suddenly I found myself with the president in his office while the Black Justice League was sitting in the office. And I'm so naive sometimes. It didn't occur to me that people would be videotaping this and that it would be sent out online. So I think you're right. There's a sense all of a sudden that, oh, right, the things I think I'm saying in a room are actually things that are circulating in ways I never anticipated.
Right.
Even sending a memo to the campus mm-hmm. is no longer really a private local act,
right,
because
yeah.
everything gets sent out. You know, we have a test sometimes. How would you feel if this were on the cover of the New York Times?
Mm-hmm.
And I actually try not to think in those terms, because, look, if something circulates more broadly than I anticipated, so be it. But my test for myself is always being comfortable saying what I want to say to the people I'm trying to say it to. Mm-hmm. You have to know you're going to get it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
After the Black Justice League sit-in, I wrote an op-ed for The Prince, you know, sort of describing how sympathetic I was to a lot of their demands, but also criticizing a bit the way President Eisgruber and I were invited out of the room in that moment, which was that they turned up the speakers and played really loud music and kind of just shut down discourse. And there was nothing else to say, so we had to leave. So I've kind of said how unfortunate I thought that moment was. And then the students said that I was tone policing, and they were kind of right. I mean, it made me, in the best of all possible worlds, you're criticized and you think about it and you think about how you would do something differently and you learn from it, which I feel like I did from that moment. But sometimes you just screw up and make mistakes, and that has to be okay too. I don't think anybody who is speaking publicly, being seen, is circulating publicly, can be expected to be perfect. And the best you can do is learn from it and do it better next time.
Sure. And so after 9 great years as dean of the college, you plan to step down on June 30th, 2024, take a 2-year sabbatical, and then retire from the faculty in 2026.
Yes.
And so what led you to this decision?
Well, partly that I thought 9 years as dean, I was good.
That's a good amount of time.
That was good. Partly that as dean, I've kind of been all in. I haven't been able to do my own research or my writing. I had a blog, as you know, that I did for 10 years and now haven't done for 10 years. So I think it's time for me to take what I've learned and maybe write about what it's meant to be a dean of a college and recenter where I want my writing to go. I really think of myself primarily as a writer and a scholar. So I am owed 2 years of sabbatical, for which I'm very grateful. I'll kind of do some of that then. And then retiring, you know, I've been an academic, obviously, my whole career. And because there's no mandatory retirement age, academics have a habit of sticking around a long time, you know, which is fine. I understand it. We all love what we do. We love to teach. We love to do the research. But the only way to renovate a faculty is when one person retires so that another person can be hired. And I have always told myself that I would not outstay my welcome and that I would step down so that somebody else could step in. And I'm just really trying to do that now. I think it's
important. Very noble.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. So you're going to do some research. You're going to do some writing during your sabbatical and retirement. But what else are you going to do? Like, is there any traveling you want to do?
Traveling. Yes, it would be very nice when you're not attached to the academic calendar to be able to go to places like New Zealand, where I'd like to be there in the summer instead of the winter. So January might be opened up for me. I am a tennis player. I'm looking forward to playing more tennis, maybe pickleball, although tennis players are very cautious about this pickleball thing.
This pickleball thing.
It's a whole different sound, and it's a little disturbing sometimes, but I'll try to do that.
Let's actually talk about the sound.
Well, the sound is it's a wiffle ball being hit by the equivalent of a ping pong paddle. So it's this really sort of brash sound, and the sound of a tennis ball being hit by a racket is music to my ears. So, and often the pickleball courts are right adjacent to the tennis courts. So it's a little dissonant, I have to say. However,
maybe they can get a soundproof pickleball court.
That one, maybe we could all wear, headphones.
Noise-canceling headphones.
There you go. That might work.
Make it so that pickleball is just tennis.
Yeah,
and then, so they're playing tennis.
Cancel pickleball.
Cancel it.
Yeah.
A lot of people would be happy.
Yeah. Cancel pickleball. And so I've read various entries in the Feminist Spectator.
Oh, how nice.
You've clearly consumed a lot of media, whether it's like TV shows, you know, movies, books over the years. So have you been able, like, while being dean of the college, have you been able to keep up with your shows, your movies?
I thought you were going to say, have I been able to write about them? And I writing about them, I have not been able to do. As you can see, the blog has been a little fallow, let's just say, for a while. But yes, I have managed to keep up with my consumption of television, of films, although a little less so, of theater, although in the pandemic, a little less difficult. Novels. I am a very voracious consumer of popular and other kinds of culture. I feel like I need it. I really enjoy storytelling and thinking about it, and I learn a lot from it. And I enjoy writing about it, so I do miss that part. But consuming, yes.
What have been your favorite things to consume in the last few years?
Also a very good question. You know, I was a little late to the Succession bandwagon.
So good.
That was really... It was really good. And you know why I think it was partly so good? There were a lot of New York actors and there were a lot of UK playwrights writing that show.
It's always the British playwright.
And some American playwrights too, but it was very theatrical in its composition. A lot of those actors I've seen on stage over the years.
Okay.
Wow.
And it was just great to watch them in a show I thought was so well written.
So well
written. And so interesting and kind of critical in terms of the power dynamics and its critique of this excessive privilege, but also very sympathetic to the dynamics of this family, which I think a lot of people could relate to in different ways.
Yeah. And the writing's so quick, so witty.
So smart. Not a thrown away word.
Oh, of course not.
In that series.
Who was your favorite character, out of curiosity?
You know, I really liked the daughter just because I thought Shiv. The gender dynamics were so complicated. And I don't know how you all feel about spoiler alerts. I won't say what happens in the end because people might not have seen it yet. But the relationship between her and her husband, I thought was so interesting and complicated.
Yeah.
And the way it all ends up, what that final gesture in the car of his hand covering hers was just full of meaning.
Well, I really hope to see an essay about Succession and the feminist spectator.
Maybe something to aspire to.
You need to watch it. Yeah. You guys need to watch it.
My family loves it, so I'm just right behind. I need to get on that train.
It's really worth it.
Yeah.
It definitely is. I've watched The Crown. I've watched White Lotus, which I think is another terrific series.
White Lotus is so good.
White Lotus. Severance is also
interesting.
Yes.
Oh my god.
Ashley, you have some catching up to do.
Yeah, I know. I'm like,
guys, get on the train.
You guys haven't seen. Well, you've seen Fleabag.
I have.
I'm a huge Fleabag.
She's wonderful.
Oh, yes.
She is so smart.
Have you seen the stage play?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, the one-woman show is also fantastic. There's a recording of it.
I should watch that.
Yeah.
Have you seen her in the Raiders of the Lost Ark continued?
I haven't seen her.
She's supposed to be very good in that, playing against the CGI youthened Harrison Ford.
Right.
Interesting.
Right.
So the Feminist Spectator won the George Jean Nathan Award for Dramatic Criticism. And then you also released a book in 2013, which included essays from, but also expanded upon your blog.
I did.
What was your
I thought you were, okay, go ahead.
No, I want you to say it.
Say it, Simon.
I want you to say it.
What was your initial vision for the blog? And did you anticipate it becoming such a celebrated work in the future?
I did not. You know, I started the blog when blogging was new and when blogging was more like tweeting than anything else. So it was supposed to be really short form.
Right.
It was something that you'd write often, but just quick little paragraphs about things. And my first blog was pretty long. And then I kind of got the hang of, you know, what it meant to write into this public forum where there were not the same rules. One of the things I liked about it was I didn't have an editor. And typically, critics who write for newspapers or magazines or radio, they work with someone who says, I want to assign you to go see this, and here's how many words you have.
Yeah.
So I really appreciated the freedom of saying, actually, I want to see this, and I'm going to take as many words as I need to say what I have to say about it. So the blog grew over the 10 years that I was working on it, and I feel like I got into a rhythm of how long and for what, but I was always very clear about who the audience was, which was someone who I thought would appreciate a kind of different view in on popular culture. Because especially when I started the blog, not as much now, most critics were men. Most of the powerful critics wrote for outlets like The Times or the big legacy newspapers. And there was just a kind of one perspective that was brought to bear on the kind of culture that was important to me. So my aim was to bring a different perspective and kind of open up the dialogue. The other thing that was surprising to me were the comments.
Oh, right.
Which interesting.
At the time,
completely unrestricted. Right?
Yes, completely unrestricted. And I had never written anything where instantaneously someone could comment. You know, as an academic, you write a book, it's published a year after you finish it.
Wow.
It goes out into the void. And if you go to a conference, someone might say, oh, I loved your book. But there's no instantaneous feedback.
What's like the craziest comment that you've received?
Oh my goodness. Some things really hit a nerve. Okay. And I got a fair amount of vitriol in those comments.
That must have prepared you for your role as a dean, too. With all the public, you know, you could
This is a very good point.
Disgruntled students.
Although,
happily, I think my blog got more of those than I have as dean. I know. But it is true. It was the beginning of that culture where you could be nasty to one another publicly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I got some of that. It always surprised me, but what it made me think was I touched a nerve, and that is kind of what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Right.
I tried to have a dialogue, although it's hard to do that in comments.
Yeah.
But it taught me a lot about how people respond differently from how I respond, and how I would have to shore up my arguments so that even if people disagreed with me, they would know why I was arguing what I was arguing.
Interesting. And it must be exciting just to see that discourse going on immediately right after you.
Yeah, it means you're talking about something important.
Right.
Exactly. It means that people care.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it was pretty nasty, I have to say. I was called a fair number of names.
Oh, no.
But that's okay. You know, I think it's unfortunate, but it didn't hurt me. And the corollary to being dean is when COVID was happening, it was really surprising the amount of hate mail I got when we announced mandatory vaccines.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
As though it was my decision. It was an institutional decision. But I got a lot of hate mail calling me terrible names.
That must be so difficult that you're the scapegoat for the whole institution.
You get to be. I think President Eisgruber got a fair amount, too.
Yeah.
But it makes you think about how accessible we are in the 21st century. People would call my office and leave terrible voicemails.
Really?
Wow.
I got at least one threat that was a little scary enough the public safety had to come see me and they had to kind of track it down and figure out where it was coming from.
Oh,
isn't that kind of astonishing?
That's really wild, that's insane.
About mandatory vaccines. I mean, of course you can argue whether we should have them, but why should you threaten the life of someone who's just telling people that it's mandatory?
Was this like a Princeton person?
I don't think so. And that was the other thing. They were random people.
So they weren't being affected.
No, they were not being affected.
Honestly, they might just be fans.
They're just avid readers of The Feminist Spectator.
They're your original blog haters.
They were just betrayed.
That's it.
They wanted the last laugh.
They followed me. Oh my God, what a terrifying thought.
The comment hate mail pipeline, it's real. It's very real. It's real.
The internet trolls to hate mail.
Exactly.
So... given the subjects and like the fields that you are interested in, you're probably familiar with our title, the Bechdel test.
I am. And you know, I even know Alison Bechdel.
Really?
I was thinking you would.
She's been to Princeton at least twice on the occasion of some of her books coming out. I've heard her speak. And I know her a little bit because of Fun Home, her musical, the musical that was based on the graphic novel that she wrote. But I do know the Bechdel test.
And so we originally named ourselves this because the host consists of two women, me and Emily, and then one man. And we often like to exclude him, just like really exclude him from the dialogue.
Right.
And so what are your thoughts on the actual Bechdel test, not this podcast?
Yes, the actual test. What I like about it and what I find scary about it is how relevant it continues to be.
Right.
What is the formulation? It passes the test if there's more than one woman talking to each other about something that's not a man. Is that
and
right?
Just yes. one conversation,
just one, like scene,
just
yeah.
one scene.
Yes.
I mean, that's not a really high
bar, at all.
And yet, so much of what I even watch continues to fail the test.
Yes.
It's just remarkable to me.
It's actually insane.
And it's remarkable insane. How you don't really think about it that much. It's like, it's almost ingrained that we're kind of like, we don't notice these things.
I know.
Unless you pay attention
unless
to
you
it.
Do, and you're like, oh my God. Like, even it's such a, like a feminist work can fail it.
It's
know,
true.
Which is interesting.
It's true. And that's what there's an elegance to its simplicity and a real disturbance to the fact that how often it's still it's upheld in so many of the stories we watch or read or see.
Does your favorite movie pass the Bechdel test?
My favorite movie? I think so. Most of my favorite movies, you know, that always changes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
One of the things I saw recently is Naiad, the movie about the swimmer, Diana Naiad. Have you seen this?
I haven't seen this.
Annette Bening and Jodie Foster. I'm a big Jodie Foster fan.
I recently just saw her in New York City.
You did?
On the street.
Were you just hanging out together?
No, I was at Goodwill with my mom, and we left, and we see Jodie Foster and her son, who actually goes to Princeton.
Really?
Kit Foster.
Yes.
And I just, I thought I recognized her. I was like, who is that? And she's a lot shorter in person than, like,
she anticipated. Is.
And yeah, it was, and I was like, well, I think that's Jodie Foster. My mom started freaking out.
Then we're like, oh, did you say hello?
Did you get a selfie?
We did not. I'm kind of wary of saying it. It's kind of an odd interaction.
So I know.
I try to just get excited and then walk away.
She's actually a lovely, very down-to-earth, and very smart person.
Yeah,
and I think a terrific performer, actually.
Oh, yeah. She's
but
amazing.
This movie is about Diana Nyad, who tried to swim from Florida to Cuba when she was 28.
Okay.
Free swim. So no, you know, she had to be in the water the whole time with no one touching her.
Wow.
It didn't work because of sharks, because of venomous jellyfish and those sorts of things.
Oh, wow.
And in her 60s, she decided she wanted to try again. She had four tries, and she finally did it. So
yes.
This movie is actually directed by a Princeton alum.
Really?
The woman who did, with her husband, Free Solo?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Wow.
That's an incredible film.
An incredible film. So she did this one, too. It's the first narrative film that she's done.
Wow.
But it's Diana Nyad and a very close friend of hers who kind of cheers her along and helps her train for this swim. I think most of my favorite movies do pass the Bechdel test.
Yes.
For obvious reasons.
Right. And so one of our final serious questions before we get into some more light questions is, in 2016, you were inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences.
How about that?
Joining the likes of Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Charles Darwin, etc., etc., etc. How did it feel joining the ranks of so many prominent change makers?
Prominent change makers and a lot of old white men on that
list.
Yeah.
True. Yeah. Very true. That is true.
I know. It was actually incredibly moving and a real testament to the fact that one of the country's oldest professional associations has made a big effort over the last years to include more women, to include more people of color. I actually now serve on an election panel, and it's really about your peers nominating you for what's essentially a really important honor. Mm-hmm. I was very moved to be elected, and they have this lovely initiation ceremony in Boston every year up around Harvard, where you go, you sign a book that becomes part of the archive of the place, and when you go to their headquarters, they have acceptance letters from people like Benjamin Franklin or some of the other really famous people that are framed around their walls. And you do feel yourself in the company of people who over centuries have been the country's thought leaders or who have had some sort of influence. So as a performance studies scholar, as a blogger, as a feminist critic, I felt very honored to be in that company and hope it means that there'll be more like me in that company.
Yeah. Indeed.
I'm curious, though, with this feminist spectator, do you feel like you, is there an essay that stands out that you think is your favorite or that was most exciting to write
in about? In that collection, you know, there's so many of them, but one that I remember most is sort of the first one.
Mm-hmm.
It was about a group called the Five Lesbian Brothers, who just in their name is a lot of fun, and their performance style was equally as fun and unusual and critical in the happiest possible way. So that first blog holds a place in my heart because it was an initiation for me, as I was saying before, and what it meant. And then there's others because I really like what I was writing about that I also appreciate. You know, one of the rules of my blog was I would only write about things that I liked for the most part.
Okay. Good.
Although it was usually the things that I didn't like that snuck in that got the most vitriolic hate.
Interesting.
The Social Network. Do you know that film?
Yes.
About Facebook?
Yes.
I didn't like it because it does not pass the Bechdel test.
That's true.
By any means. And I wrote a pretty unusually harsh critique about that film on my blog. Boy, did I get hammered on that one.
I just watched that recently.
Did
and
you?
She called me afterward.
It made me so uncomfortable.
Oh,
I just, like, really didn't. I watched it during my break, and it was just, like,
It's also related to like Princeton experiences and just
like social climbing and jealousy.
Those scenes of the women being bused to the clubs.
Yes.
I know.
Yes.
I'll be honest, I thought it was so good.
You did. I think
it's a great movie.
I feel like it was good, but it was just like after the movie ended and I just felt so like uneasy. Like it just like, I don't know. It really sparked some emotion.
It sparked something in you.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
And because it's a good movie, I think it does that.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah. And so now, we're going to swivel into some Princeton trivia.
Ah.
I didn't
know there were tests in this conversation.
The Bechdel test. Ah. Some of these are like kind of Princeton slang popular among the undergraduate student body. And some of it's more like general knowledge. But I guess we'll jump into it.
And no pressure, because there's some of these that I might not even.
Yeah.
I don't think I know.
I didn't know some of them either.
I had to do research, so okay. Don't feel bad.
Okay. I do not have any devices with me.
That's all right. Let it be known. Do you know what NARP stands for?
NARP?
N-A-R-P.
I know what NARC stands for. I do not know what NARP.
If we wanted to use NARP in a sentence, it would be, me, Simon, and Emily are NARPs. We are not on any Princeton athletic teams.
Oh. I didn't know.
So, and it stands for something, N-A-R-P?
Mm-hmm. Not athletic, non-athletic.
So, yes, that's correct.
R-P.
Regular person.
Regular person.
Yeah. Yes. I'm going to use that.
You should.
Okay, NARP.
Yeah, so indeed. We got NARPs and athletes.
Yeah. That's the big divide.
Yeah, that's the big divide.
On students. Campus, it is. Indeed. I understand.
Indeed. Do you know how many eating clubs start with the letter C?
Ooh, I should. Half of them? Five.
Pretty much, yes.
Six.
Yes.
Five, six.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That was close.
And can you name all 11 eating clubs?
Terrace, Tower, Ivy, Tiger, Cloister, Charter. No, am I making it up?
No. Yeah.
Colonial.
Mm-hmm.
There must be five more.
How many? 11.
There's 11. Mm-hmm. So I'm missing four.
There's quad.
Quadrangle club.
Quadrangle club.
Cap and gown.
Another C. Mm.
Cottage.
Yeah.
You and say Ivy?
I did say
yeah, she's,
did I say Ivy?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tower?
I did say tower.
Cannon?
I don't think I
said
cannon.
I forget. Yeah, cannon. Cannon.
All right.
Okay.
If you ask me again, I'd probably remember others and forget others.
Indeed.
I don't think I would be able to get
No, I couldn't remember this entire list. I had to look it up. okay, now name the Princeton tradition. A moment of collective campus catharsis at midnight each dean's date when students gather in Holder Courtyard in Rocky to release a primal scream of fear and frustration.
What am I supposed to do with that?
What
is it called? I do not know.
It's alliterative. It's holder.
Hold
blank.
Holder something holler.
Oh.
Ooh.
Close.
Holder holler.
The holder howl.
The holder howl.
Yeah. Indeed.
Okay.
There you go.
Indeed.
All right. I think I have heard about this.
Yes. It'll be coming soon. It'll be coming in a week. In a week's time.
You know, that's my day.
That is your day.
It's my day.
That's when you're
I've never been invited
campus.
To the
That's
to
your
the
birthday,
holder
Dean's
howl.
Date. Simon or Emily, you want to take
yes.
a...
This place on campus offers free cookies to students.
Murray Dodge.
Yes.
Murray
ding, Dodge ding, ding.
Very good.
Emily?
The sophomore rite of passage consisting of running naked through Holder Courtyard at midnight on the night of each year's first snowfall was banned in 1999.
And what was it called?
I don't think I know about this.
I didn't know about this either.
And thanks, guys, for making me read
that one.
Yeah,
of course.
Nude Olympics.
The Nude Olympics.
What it was called.
Indeed.
Okay.
And so now you know.
And our first snowfall was yesterday, wasn't it? Or was it 2 days ago?
So did you guys partake in that? Or
no, it was banned in 1999.
It was banned. Oh, sorry.
Well, I do my own little personal one.
Inappropriate. That's inappropriate.
Well, I do it in my room in private.
Okay. Oh my gosh. Why do all these things happen in Holder courtyard?
Holder's a crazy place. Sure. Holder's a crazy place.
I'm the farthest removed from that because I'm in Yay.
Oh, so. You're in Yay.
All right, I'm in Forbes, so I'm not even on campus.
Right.
There'll be new traditions in Yay.
If you had to stay in any eating club or any residential college, which one would it
yeah,
be?
Yeah, what's your favorite child? Which residential college?
If I had to live in one?
Yeah.
I have to say New College West, yep. Yay. I love the glass box.
Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
I also participated in designing and
I was gonna ask,
those buildings with, again, Rochelle Calhoun, Chad Klaus, who's the VP for University Services. We were all about what's a program that's going to go in there? What should it be like? It was really fun to work with architects.
Oh, I bet.
Builders, you know, it was hard getting those open on time.
Right. Indeed. Yeah. Indeed.
But I really do like them. And they have head of college houses that so you actually could live in them.
Mm-hmm. And the food is fantastic.
The food is amazing.
Yes. Would they have head of college houses in the buildings?
They're in, there are first quote-unquote embedded head of college houses. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other ones are on mostly University Place. Mm-hmm. So these are the first ones that are actually part of the college. So the head can go through the college without going outside.
That's so interesting.
That's awesome. I lived right above. I was on the first floor and right below was the head of college last year.
Oh, okay.
Which sometimes I was like, it's just... It was odd to me. I was like, I'm really living above like a family right now. I know. It's also comforting.
It's supposed, that's right. It's supposed to make you feel happy and warm and comforted.
Yeah. There's a home here.
There's a home here. Right. Exactly.
Right. Next question. This is the biggest social event of the year. Everyone who is anyone is in attendance. Name that social event.
It's a little vague, Sophia.
That social event. It's not lawn parties.
It's not lawn parties.
That's the right answer.
That is the correct answer. This is a kind of a joke.
I am talking about the orange and black ball.
Oh, the orange and black ball.
Which is a huge social event. And the whole campus goes to it.
The whole.
She's being a little bit facetious. But.
No,
a
lot of freshmen attend the orange and black ball because it's the only.
Thinking it's something bigger, I think, than it actually is.
It's the only formal that is. That people like of all grades can attend.
Yeah.
And it occurs in Dillon Gym.
Yes.
But my good friend Shannon, who's on USG, helps facilitate it. And so we like to call it the biggest social event of the year.
I see.
What eating club did Jeff Bezos, class of 1986, belong to?
Oh, I have no idea.
And you don't need to. You should know this.
Terrace.
Quad.
Okay.
Indeed. I think we're ready to swivel to our final segment.
Let's do it.
I think so.
This is called Message in a Bottle. So the way it works is that our previous guest, who doesn't know who the next guest is going to be, asks a question into the universe. And that question... is now yours to answer.
Okay.
This one is very convoluted. We don't know how this person.
Yeah, I also was like scrambling to write it as the person was saying it. So it's not necessarily English.
Okay. But
we will try to translate it.
Indeed. Simon or Emily, you want to take it?
I can read it.
Okay.
If in this moment you were transported back in time to before humans have touched the world, so you're surrounded by nature, trees,
primordial swamp.
Yes. Indeed.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's just you, but you have all the knowledge that you have right now. And you have a button. And every time you press this button, you clone yourself. How many times do you think you'd need to clone yourself to make a light bulb? And if you make this light bulb, you get to return safely to your old life. This life. But if you die, humanity is over as we know it.
Or if you don't make the light bulb, I think
but also like if you end up
right.
Yeah.
If your clones end up fighting
something like that.
For some reason this question is choking me up. Okay,
she's been dying to answer this question.
Yeah, right. I've been thinking about this for a long time. I have to clone my so the basis of this question is how many something does it take to
make a light bulb.
How many use? How many Dean Dolans does it take to make a light bulb?
To make a light bulb.
You know, knowing me, I just completely I think humanity's done.
I have no light bulb knowledge.
Yeah, I don't know how to do that.
How to make a light bulb? I think it would take, how many of me's would I have to clone to make the light bulb that would save humanity? Is that the basic question?
Indeed.
I think I would need just one more clone of me because I would need somebody to talk it over with.
Really?
And think through ideas. Yeah, and try things out. And I think that would be it.
Do you think you'd like a clone of yourself?
Probably not.
That's an interesting question because I feel like, Emily, you said you wouldn't like a clone of yourself.
No, and I'm afraid that I would make too many of myself and I would end up having to kill them.
Okay. Speaking of popular culture, there was a really interesting novel that came out a few years ago. It was originally in French and was translated to English about these time loops where a plane full of passengers was caught in this loop, and it wound up that they were kind of cloned, but then found a way to meet one another.
Interesting.
I mean, it was kind of really interesting. And of course, I should know the name of the book, and it's escaping me at this point. But it raises that question. What is it like to meet yourself?
Yeah.
Who's not exactly yourself, but might be yourself? It was interesting.
I think there's definitely a rise in those sorts of metaverse that's really a theme, I think, in popular culture recently.
I think you should write a blog entry about it.
I would say so.
Or maybe my clone will.
Indeed.
After we do the life check.
There's probably a Dean Jill Dolan that's writing that blog right now.
In the next dimension.
I hope so. Yeah. It'd be nice to have somebody, my front person.
Right.
Getting things ready for me. Drafting.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you possess light bulb knowledge?
Light bulb knowledge? Absolutely not.
But you think just with two
by
of
having
you?
We could figure it out.
Okay, wow.
Mm. I think we could.
This is, wow.
What do you think, what kind of knowledge, do you feel like you have the most depth and most specificity on? Like, what topic in particular?
What a good question. I would say theater, because that's sort of my field. Mm-hmm. But if I were to expand that, I would say that my sort of wheelhouse is thinking about what things mean and what they do in the world, whether that's interactions with people or popular culture or, I'm a performance studies scholar, so I think a lot about even these exchanges as performance and how you can think about the dynamics and what they mean and how they go. So I guess... that's where my expertise is, and it applies to lots of situations.
That's the really
hopefully even to making a light bulb.
Right. Yeah. Indeed. Well, that is actually our time.
Yes.
But
thank you so much for sharing this time with me.
Thank you for coming on, Dean Dolan.
It is my pleasure.
Thank you.
A semester before the end of my deanship.
Yay!
Thank you.
Thank you.
So many students wanted you on
this
podcast.
Oh, indeed.
We've gotten lots of requests for this.
We sent out a survey and it was like, who would you want to hear on the Bechdel test?
Dean Dolan. Nice. Tell them all to send me nice comments.
Indeed. That comment section will be full of positivity.
Oh, yeah.
And check out that first essay, and then that'll be your foray into the Feminist Spectator.
Indeed. And maybe we'll see some new essays.
Maybe we
will.
Stay tuned. That'll be part two of this conversation.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you to our listeners. That's our season, folks.
Yeah, it's been a great season.
It's been real. Have a great winter holiday.
Yes. And we have a lot in store for next season as well.
So much in store.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, just wait.
You guys are not ready.
Oh, just wait. All right. Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye.